We've all heard the phrase before, or seen it, or read it on a bumper sticker or a t-shirt. He who dies with the most toys wins, right? And our core, instinctively, we know that there's no truth in a statement like that. However, there are moments and there are times when we become a little jealous of people who have more toys than we do. And there are moments and individual decisions where maybe our life isn't based on a value system like that one, but we make a decision here, or there's a moment over here where we kind of sort of live by it, where we kind of sort of believe that life at its core is about the accumulation of stuff or toys or acclaim or fame or riches or success. And so we kind of live by the and die by the mantra of he or she who has the most toys wins. There was this guy who was a very, very successful coach 20 or so years ago. His name's Jim Valvano. And this was a guy who his basketball team, the North Carolina State University, they beat one of the most talented college basketball teams of all time. They beat the University of Houston with Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler. And some of you are like, wow, those are big names. Some of you are like, I have no idea who those people are. Which is why I don't use sports analogies very often. But this is more of like a life analogy. So if you don't know who those people are, bear with me. They were talented. Okay. And so this guy, in this moment, this is him, Jim Valvano, and he had just won the national championship in basketball, and he spent his whole life coaching basketball, and he reached the highest heights of his profession, and he was on TV, and he was famous, and he was wealthy, and he was a level of success very few of us will ever reach in his life. But that moment faded, and years go by, he was let go. And then a few years after that, he was diagnosed with cancer. And eventually the cancer took his life. And a couple months before the cancer took his life, he gave a very famous speech at the first ever ESPYs award on ESPN. And this is a 30-second clip of that speech.
And when people say to me, how do you get through life or each day, the same thing. To me, there are three things we all should do every day. We do this every day of our life. You're going to have, what a wonderful, number one is laugh. You should laugh every day. Number two is think. You should spend some time in thought. And number three is you should have your emotions move to tears. Could be happiness or joy. Think about it. If you laugh, you think, and you cry, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day. You do that 7 days a week, you're going to have something special.
And so there's this guy, and he was, by all accounts, by every measurement you could possibly, by every metric, successful, wealthy, well-known, famous. But a month before that speech, he was being interviewed by Sports Illustrated, kind of like a retrospective on his life. Like, tell us about your life. You know, you have cancer now. You've been wildly successful. Tell us about what it means, what it's like to be Jim Valvano. And he says this in a Gary Smith article in Sports Illustrated. He says, it just clobbers me. You get sick, and you say to yourself, sports means nothing. And that feels terrible. I've devoted my whole life to it. And so this guy, who is this wildly successful guy, and famous and wealthy, and reached the highest heights of his profession, and we look back at his life, he had invested his life into sports, and he realized, I've devoted my life to it, and it has meant nothing. Take another guy, a guy named Larry Walters. So this is a guy who many of you maybe have heard of, maybe you maybe not have heard of this guy. This is a guy who, when he was 13 years old, was walking through an Army-Navy surplus store, and he saw a giant balloon. And in his mind, he cooked up an idea that it was going to take him 20 years to fulfill. Fast forward 20 years down the road, he's attaching giant balloons to a lawn chair in his girlfriend's backyard. And his idea is this. He's going to fill 42 weather balloons with helium. And he's going to attach them to a lawn chair. He's going to bring a BB gun with him. And he's going to go 100 feet in the air and on one tether and then make sure it's stable. And then go 1,000 foot in the air with a second tether and make sure that's stable. And then he's just going to, after a while, after he's up in that 1,000 feet in the air, he's going to, with a BB gun, shoot the balloons out one at a time and then gently float back to his girlfriend's backyard and have accomplished his life sort of like dream and goal. And so he does this. He sets up his lawn chair. In the previous picture, it says lawn chair pilot, because that's how he referred to himself. And so he sets up this lawn chair in his girlfriend's backyard with two tethers, with 42 weather balloons full of helium attached to them. And he's got a, and he's armed with a BB gun. And as he gets into the chair, the upward force of the balloons rips both tethers. And so he flies instantly 16,000 feet into the air. Wind takes him, and he floats over LAX airport. Two separate commercial airline pilots report back in. They're like,
"We got a guy in a lawn chair up here."
After a while, the wind changes, and he goes back relatively close to where he started. He shoots out after an hour plus, 16,000 feet in the air, in a lawn chair. He shoots out the balloons, and he floats gently back to Earth. But his chair gets caught in a power line, and the police have to come and cut him out of, you know, down from the power line. And they arrest him, but they can't figure out what to charge him with. So they give him a $1,500 fine for unlawful entry into LAX airspace in his lawn chair. They're like, "If you had a pilot's license, we'd revoke it right now, but you don't, so don't do it again." And so about a month later, he's on David Letterman's show. And David Letterman asked him, he's like, "Man, Larry, the lawn chair pilot, why'd you do it? Like, why'd you go 1,600 feet into the air, or 16,000 feet, I'm sorry, 16,000 feet in the air on a lawn chair?" And his answer was, "A man can't just sit around his whole life." As if going 16,000 feet in the air is the only other option to sitting around. And then he asks him in the interview, he says, "Well, Larry, are you going to do it again?" He says, "Well, no, I'm not allowed to legally." And he says, "That was the fulfillment, the successful fulfillment of a 20-year dream." He says, "David, I have achieved inner peace." And David's like, "Oh, okay. Well, let's cut to commercial then." Right? On that note. And so this guy, Larry Walters, in this moment has achieved inner peace because he had fulfilled his dream for his life. But then he tried to, you know, start a successful business as a motivational speaker, and that didn't take. And he tried other sort of ventures, and that didn't take. And eventually, you know, 20 years down the road, he spent the better part of a decade as a late night security guard, and he had not achieved inner peace. And so he wandered into the woods one day and took his own life. And this is somebody 20 years earlier who on national television is talking about how he's achieved inner peace. So what you have, two men who, one, in every sort of standard or metric possible, had achieved unbelievable success and wealth and fame. And this other guy had set an outlandish, crazy, ridiculous dream for his life, and he achieved it. And neither one liked where they ended up. Neither one felt like they had used their life well. And so, we ended up right where we started out. When the phrase, "He who dies with the most toys wins," we realize, we know, fundamentally, instinctively, there's no truth to be found in a statement like that. So then what? What do we do with our lives then? I mean, what do we do with our days on this earth? This verse in John chapter 12. And this is Jesus kind of answering this question. He's looking at his people who follow him, whose lives are marked by him. And he's telling them basically the answer to this exact question. He's saying, if you want to have a life that is meaningful, if you want to have a life that is fulfilling, if you want to have a life that you look back on it at the end of your days and you're like, "Man, I lived well," do this. I tell you the truth. Unless a kernel of wheat is planted in the soil and dies, it remains alone. And there's a statement like, unless the kernel of wheat does this thing, then it will live its life alone. And you're like, "Well, I don't know that wheat feels alone." You're giving the wheat human qualities. That's called anthropomorphic. But anyway, neither here nor there. But unless the wheat, a kernel of wheat, is planted in the soil and dies. Now, if you plant a kernel of wheat in the soil, you don't eat it, but you do get more wheat. That wheat does become more wheat. And that wheat it becomes can become even more wheat. And that wheat that wheat becomes even exponentially more wheat. And so unless you take this wheat and plant it, and it gives its life to grow fruit in other people's trees, it will remain alone. But its death will produce many new kernels, a plentiful harvest of new lives. So what you have, like I don't have wheat because you can't buy wheat at the grocery store. But what I have here is an avocado. And this avocado, like let's say this avocado, it wanted to maximize its own glorious avocado-ness, right? I mean, it wanted to be the most beautiful, the most wrinkly. I mean, I think avocados would find wrinkles beautiful, I think, right? Like, I don't know what. Different than us, we don't like wrinkles, avocados would like, I don't know. I've never been an avocado. But you didn't think you were going to hear that phrase today, did you? I've never been an avocado. But yeah, give this avocado. And let's say it wants to be the most beautiful, the most respected avocado ever. And it spends its life wanting to be a beloved avocado. And then after like, I don't know, what is it? Like, if they're like hard, rotten. Like, I don't know why avocados are that way. They're a really frustrating fruit. And by the way, they are fruit because there's a seed. It's like, I want to be the best avocado ever. And so it lives its life wanting to maximize its own avocado-ness. But the alternative is it looks at its life differently. It doesn't say, I want to maximize my own amazingness. I want to, in essence, based on the verse, invest my entire life, live and die, growing fruit in other people's trees. The thing is, an avocado, it lasts, what, a week? I don't know, two, three? And the Bible says that our life is what, a vapor, a mist? But if you plant an avocado seed into the ground with the right light and the right fertilizer and the right environment, then what happens is it becomes an avocado tree. And that avocado tree becomes so many more avocados. And each one of those avocados has the ability to become even more avocados. And it multiplies out over and over and over and over again. This avocado can either live and die for its own exceptional avocado-ness, or it can have a real legacy of life, becoming more life, becoming more life, becoming more life. So put John back up for me, would you? I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat is planted in the soil and dies, it remains alone. But its death will produce many new kernels, a plentiful harvest of new lives. 2 Timothy chapter 4 says it this way. As for me, this is Paul, by the way. This is Paul, and he's writing a letter to someone he's invested in. He has invested his whole life into other people. And he's poured himself out, and he is moments from death. Similar to that speech you heard a few seconds of earlier, this is his version of that speech. I mean, he is days from his death. And he's writing to this person he's invested in for years. As for me, my life has already been poured out as an offering to God. The time of my death is near. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race, and I have remained faithful. And so what we have in front of us is two options. We can either just pursue toys and success and fame and comfortable and look back at our life and be like, I've devoted my life to this and it has meant nothing. Or we can pour ourselves out growing fruit in other people's trees. I mean, living and dying for it. And we can finish our lives, look back at our lives with this sort of, just sort of pride and like, I've done a good job. I have invested my life into something that mattered. I have fought the fight. I have finished the race. I have remained faithful. That's what this series is about for the next 4 weeks. We're going to be asking you to look at your life and make a decision with it. Are you going to pursue more toys, more fame, more comfortable? Or are you going to pour yourself out every moment, every day to grow fruit in other people's trees? And here's the thing. The best time to plant a tree is 30 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. So for the next 4 weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to grow fruit in other people's trees. Start today. And then today, and then for the rest of our time today, and next week, we're going to ask you, there's some things that you have to know. Know these two things, today and next week. And then after the next 2 weeks after that, it's now that you know those two things, do these two things. All right? So it's good. This is how the whole thing's going to system out. It's the system of how it's going to work. This week, next week, know these two things. The following 2 weeks, do these two things. Okay? So now that we have that, and let's say that you are hypothetically with me, and you're like, all right, Jake, I'm going to invest my life into growing fruit in other people's trees, and I have to know something. What do I have to know? Like, what does I have to know today if I'm going to grow fruit in other people's trees for the rest of my life? If I'm going to look back at my life and just be so fulfilled and proud of the way I lived? So there's this word that was common use back in the day in biblical times and before. This was this word, euangelion. This is the Greek word. This is the Greek word, euangelion. And it meant a royal messenger or a royal message. Okay? And so this was someone, let's say the king or the Caesar in Roman times, and there was like the old Caesar had died and a new Caesar was taking the throne. Then the Caesar would send out a euangelion, a royal message, and with a euangelion, it's the same word for both, with his royal messenger, basically saying, I am the new Caesar. Congratulations. You now have me as your king. You should enjoy that because I'm going to be awesome. Congratulations again. I'm the king. And he sent this out in a message, and this euangelion, and this euangelion would carry it because it's both the message and the messenger. And so there's actually biblical references of like King David and him sending out royal decrees and like 2 Samuel's, and he's sending out a euangelion, and it's carried by a runner, a euangelion. And this is a euangelion is a royal messenger or a royal message. And then you have Jesus, and he enters the scene, and he is this rabbi, and he's approaching faith, and he's approaching life, and he's approaching hope differently than anyone ever had before. And he's asking people to come and live their life according to his life and base their life off of his. And then he does this crazy thing, and he goes and he dies on a cross. But then the most unbelievable thing ever happens. He comes back to life 3 days later, and then he disappears again. And as people are looking around, the people who pursue Jesus, whose life is marked by Jesus, they're like, man, how do we refer to ourselves? Like, what do we even, like, how do we even understand what it is we're doing here? And they read it in what they had in their Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, how time and time again, the Bible is this book where God is sending someone. It says so-and-so was sent by God. You know, Luke says the prophets were sent by God. Actually, 44 times in the Gospels, it says that Jesus was sent by God. In John 1:6, it says John the Baptist was sent by God. Jesus, in Matthew 10, sends the 12 out on a mission trip. In Luke 10:1, Jesus sends 72 people out on the mission trip. If you step back from the Bible, each individual verse, and look at it across the breadth and depth of all of it, you see that over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, it's this book where God is coming to someone, revolutionizing their life, and sending them out. All right, I'm coming, I'm redefining you, I'm recalibrating you, and I send you. I'm coming in, I'm recalibrating you, I'm sending you. I'm coming in, I'm changing you, I'm sending you. I'm coming in, and you don't think that you're worthy, but I do, because I love you and I'm sending you. And so these people who were having their lives marked by Jesus, they're like, all right, well, what do we call ourselves? Like, how do we refer to ourselves? And so they landed on the euangelion. Now, if you're going to translate this word euangelion to English, because it has two meanings to it, two separate words become euangelion, English has taken this one word and made it two. So it either means good news or gospel, if it refers to the message from the king, or if it refers to the messenger. The most direct English translation to euangelion is evangelical. And so what you have is the people of Jesus, after he left, decided to call themselves euangelion, the messengers of the king. And the message from the king, they wanted to call it the gospel or the good news, because there's a new king. But they were like subverting the system, right? Because he wasn't this king who was going to come in and kill you if you didn't like abide. He wasn't this king who wanted to like live by like might and by power and by armies. He was this king who wanted to bring hope and love and peace and meaning. And he wanted you to know that you were the Evangelion. See, something that happens when a Evangelion would come out is, let's say a Evangelion from the king would come into like the center of like, I don't know, like Lowell, downtown Lowell. And let's say like there's a new Caesar in town and you should align with Caesar. Now, how you responded to, how you treated that Evangelion was a direct correlation to how you would treat the Caesar. And so if you harmed that Evangelion, it was as if you harmed the Caesar, and they would come and they would punish you severely. And if you didn't listen to, then they would come back and they would harm you severely. So this guy, he was basically the walking, talking manifestation of the king. And he represented the king, and he had the protection of the king, and he was defined by the king. So this is where we are. If we are the Evangelion, if you believe that Jesus defines your life, what they did is they took this word, messenger of the king, carrying the message of the king. I said, that's who we are. That's what my life is going to be. It's in this verse, in Romans 10, 14 through 15, it says this way. But how can they call on him? They, people who need Jesus, call on him, Jesus, to save them unless they believe in him. And how can they believe in him if they have not ever heard about him? And how can they hear about him unless someone tells them? And how will anyone go and tell them without being sent, without being a Evangelion? That is why the scriptures say, how beautiful are the feet of the Evangelion who bring the Evangelion, the messengers who bring the good news. And so if you are someone who says, man, I want my life to matter, I want to grow fruit in other people's trees, the first thing you have to know is that you are inherently sent. You are sent as the messenger of the king carrying the good news. This is, you are not, it's like living your life, living paycheck to paycheck, paying bills. No, no, no. And maybe it feels that way when your eyes come down off the larger vision for your life and they come down to the details. It's hard to always keep our eyes on the larger picture of our own lives because we get distracted by the details of our life. But when we take our eyes and we put them back on the larger picture, we are not just, I don't know, cogs in the wheel that is the American dream. We are the messengers of the king carrying the good news. So, we are sent because Jesus was sent. We are sent because Jesus was sent. There's this verse in John 20, 21 that says this, as the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. And this is Jesus talking to people whose lives are marked by him. And I love this verse, and even though it's only a few words long, it's this very deep, sort of meaningful verse. And the first thing we understand about it is this, is that we are sent because Jesus was sent. There's this guy named Michael Goheen, and he says this. He says, before we can see the cross as something done for us, we have to see it as something done by us. It's actually John Stott. Oh, it is. I'm sorry, the other one? John Stott? There you go. Before we can see the cross as something done for us, we have to see the cross as something done by us. And the thing is, like, this is, like, we know, like, if, instinctively know, if you spend any time in church, that Jesus came and he died on the cross because he loves you. And he wants you to have an opportunity to have a relationship with God. And so we love that part of it. But also, we have to understand that Jesus came and he died because he loves you. And he had to die because he loves you. Because you and I and we, all of us, are imperfect people, flawed. And this is not to cause shame in any of us, but rather to look openly and honestly at our own imperfections. And then in the light of that, knowing that Jesus saw those imperfections and loved us in spite of that, came and died. And so, yes, the cross is something that he did for us, but the cross is something that is done by us. And so for him to turn around and say, like, now that I have died for you because I love you, for him to say, I gave my life for you, now you give your life for me. Like, we love in church world to talk about how you should pray a prayer and then come to church, and man, you're good. Like, that's what it means to be a follower of Jesus. That's what a Christian life looks like. They start out, pray a prayer, sing some songs, come to church, do it again, do it again, do it again. And that's what the life means. The life marked by Jesus means coming to church, sitting, and then leaving, and then coming back and sitting, and then leaving again, and then coming back and sitting and leaving again. But you're going to find that in the Bible, in the actual words of Jesus. What you're going to find is someone who came because he loved you and died for you, and then says, now turn around and return the favor. Now I lived and died for you. Now you live and die for me. So we are sent because he was sent. The second point is this, is that we are sent in the manner that he was sent. Michael Goheen says this, the guy I thought it was before. Says when it, in John 20:21, it says, as the Father sent me, so I sent you. The as in this passage tells us that the mission of Jesus to Israel is a paradigm for the mission of his followers to the nations. And so when it says, as the Father sent me, what he's saying is, it's not just that we are sent because he was sent, but we are sent in the manner that he was sent. As I am sent is as you are sent. So you're not just sent, but you're sent in the manner that Jesus was sent. So how was Jesus sent? Jesus wasn't sent, if you look at who he invested his life in, his time in, he didn't really invest his time in his life into thousands and thousands of people. He kind of invested into 12. But if you really look at it, he invested it into like 3. And he spent a lot of time investing in these 3. And then these 3 people carried his mission. And these 3 people, like this one seed became 3, like the avocado. And then these 3 became 3 more each. And then you have 9. And then you fast forward and you have people and it's multiplying and it's millions of people. But it's because he invested well into a couple, into a few, into like 3. And so I ask you, if life at its core is about growing fruit in other people's trees, and if you do that, then you'll feel like you've lived your life in a fulfilling, and you'll be proud of the way you've lived. Then who are you investing in? Like, who are your 1 or your 2 or your 3? I mean, if Jesus was God in human form and he had 3, then, I mean, 1 is a pretty amazing accomplishment. Like, just shoot for 1, all right? And so we are sent because he was sent, and we are sent in the manner he was sent. You know, and honestly, what happens now is like, so people whose life is marked by Jesus, they come to these things called churches, and then churches, they have like 2 numbers that define success, right? There are 2 numbers that churches define success by, and they want these numbers to always be up and to the right. And those 2 like measurements or numbers are people and money. How'd you guys know that? People and money, right? Every church, you know, when pastors get together, you know what happens? They lie. What you're running? 5,000. No. What's your offering? 72 million, right? It's because our successful community of lives marked by Jesus is numbers of attendees and dollars. Those are terrible numbers. Those 2 numbers do not any way, shape, or form, even a little, define a successful community of people marked by Jesus. A successful community of people who look to and are lives marked by Jesus are not measured by their seating capacity. If we ultimately are the Evangelion and we are sent people, then it's not our seating capacity, but our sending capacity. Don't tell me how much you're running. Tell me how many you're sending. Don't tell me what you're offering was, tell me how many people you sent with that money. Like you, in your heart, in your life, and I'm talking about people you can be invested in, chances are faces came in your heart. They came to your mind. And either we as a community bring you in and encourage you and help you grow to this sort of like hopeful, healthy place. And then we send you back out, or we are failing. The point is not to get bigger and more impressive and bigger and more impressive, more people, more money. The point is to send. So if you, in this moment, like you're like, man, I feel sent to these people in my office, then great. Be invested in those people's lives and then attend here. But if you're like, man, I feel sent to, I don't know, Zimbabwe. Great, go. Like, I want you to go. Because if you stay here, we're failing you. Churches are not measured by their seating capacity, but by their sending capacity. You are the euangelion, the messenger of the king, carrying the message of the king. You go in the manner of Jesus. Let's close in prayer. Jesus, what's so crazy to me is that you would pick us to represent you. That in this place, in this time, in light of our imperfections, that you would say, no, I want you to go. You represent me. You are the only representative of me these people will ever see. And you do that, and you look at us, and you say, yes, you go. That is crazy. But I am honored, and I am terrified and thrilled, and I also own it, God. I am your sent one, and I will invest my life into growing fruit into other people's trees. And God, as we move into this, into the rest of our days, and we have the Super Bowl tonight, and that's going to be so much fun, we're going to eat nachos and whatever else, I don't know. But let's not forget that we are ultimately the sent ones, that we are the euangelion, carrying the euangelion. We are the messengers carrying the message of the king, and we represent the king. So we are so grateful, and we love you. Give us the strength and the honesty and the wisdom to move out carrying this message forward into our lives. Maybe it's one person, two people, three people. We are to carry this forward into the manner that you did. And so don't let us forget that person or those people we thought of that we could be investing our lives into. We could be growing fruit into their trees. So we love you and we thank you. In your name, amen.